This is Practice in Place, Law and Justice Go Viral, a podcast that asks the question, how does a profession governed by precedent respond to the unprecedented? Practice in Place investigates how the practice of law and the administration of justice have adapted under the abrupt constraints of the COVID-19 era, how that has affected how and whether we achieve justice, and how those changes and that experience might or should change the practice, the profession, and its procedures forever. I am Susie Solomon, clinical professor of law and director of the legal writing program at the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law. I'll be your host. In past episodes of the podcast, we've primarily focused on how the pandemic has affected the profession and the courts generally. In this episode, we spend some time learning about the very direct impact that the virus that causes COVID-19 had on an individual member of the profession. For many lawyers, especially those of us who spent time in big law is lawyer slang for large corporate law firms with offices in urban centers, or for those of us who follow Supreme Court clerk selections the way others follow the NFL draft, David Latt seems like someone we know. We've all bookmarked Above the Law, the news and commentary website about law firms, legal education, and the legal profession that Latt founded back in 2006. Above the Law has broken some of the biggest law firm and legal education news of the last decade and a half, including law firm implosions, law school scandals, and outrageous acts by lawyers and law students alike. Above the Law is the place to go for insider takes on the most interesting aspects of the practice of law and administration of justice. Or maybe Above the Law's writers just make it all seem more interesting. Anyway, it's the perfect mix of gossip and serious legal analysis, sometimes intertwined. It also probably serves as a much-needed check on some questionable behavior. You don't want to end up in Above the Law resonates with everyone from law deans and big law managing partners to first-year law students. Now, David left the helm of Above the Law in 2019 to become managing director of a legal recruiting firm called Lateral Link. But he continues to write columns for the site. And David's Twitter is a must-follow, offering sharp observations, educated and often uncannily accurate predictions, and sometimes even breaking news about the profession and the judiciary. So it's hard to believe it now, but back in late February and even into the early days of March 2020, for most of us in legal education and the legal profession, it was business as usual. We'd heard about this virus that was causing a lot of problems in this one region in China and now seemed to have reached Europe and maybe a small area in Washington State, but we were still traveling to visit clients, attending hearings in crowded courtrooms, presenting at conferences, and shepherding students to moot court competitions. If you had told us that schools and businesses would close, shelter-in-place orders would prevail across the country, that we'd be canceling conferences into 2021 and beyond, that the Supreme Court of the United States would be hearing oral arguments by telephone? Well, I know I wouldn't have believed it. When news broke in mid-March of 2020 that David Latt had been hospitalized in New York and diagnosed with COVID-19, for some of us, all of a sudden, this thing felt all too real. And then when we read that he'd been put on a ventilator and the prognosis was grim, I mean, here was someone young, healthy, vigorous. He'd run the New York City Marathon twice and routinely logged 25 miles walking each week. Here's someone with the best healthcare, someone who came into our homes and offices and subway rides every day with the latest law nerd gossip. Those of us who obsessively checked Above the Law for breaking legal scandals now turned to scanning for updates on David's condition several times a day, hoping for good news. Fortunately, David rebounded. And on April 1st, he announced via Twitter that after 17 days in the hospital, six of which he spent on a ventilator, he was being released. That tweet is still pinned at the top of his feed, complete with a smiling hospital bed selfie. So back in May, Professor Tessa Dysart interviewed David Latt for the podcast. Tessa and David talked about his experiences with COVID-19 and his insights into how the pandemic has affected the legal profession and the judiciary. Here's Tessa.
So David, welcome. Why don't you tell us just a little bit, how are you feeling now?
Well, thanks for having me, Tessa. It's great to be here. And overall, I'm feeling good. It's been as of today, May 11, I guess. It's been about 6 weeks since I've been out of the hospital, and I'm feeling good. I have good energy. I feel very clear-headed. I'm eating well, sleeping well. My main issues are I still have a residual cough, but it's different from the COVID cough. I think it's really a result of lung issues from that. And my voice is a little hoarse. That's from damage to my vocal cords from being on a ventilator for 6 days. And I get a little short of breath from minor exertion, whereas before I used to be able to exercise pretty vigorously. So that also, I think, is a result of lung issues. But overall, I feel quite good.
Good. I am so glad to hear that. And it's good that you're sleeping well, because you have a two-year-old, yeah. And I know that doesn't
yes.
always go hand in hand. So tell us a little bit about your experience with COVID.
Yeah, so I came down with symptoms in early March, and initially it was just fatigue. And my husband and I, we live in New York, we didn't think it was COVID-19 at the time, because even though it was in the news, at the time that I started feeling fatigue, there were fewer than 50 confirmed cases in New York. So I thought it's probably just the flu or some other bug. Then I got worse. I got fever, chills, aches. And then I called my primary care doctor, spoke over the phone with a physician's assistant, and she said, oh, maybe it sounds like flu turned into bronchitis. She gave me some antibiotics, said I should feel better. I took the antibiotics. I didn't feel better. And at that point, I was having difficulty breathing. The cough had worsened into trouble breathing. And so that took me to the emergency room of my local hospital, NYU Langone. And initially, I went there, and I wasn't admitted the first time I went because I guess they thought my condition was not bad enough, and they wouldn't give me a COVID test because it's very hard to get a COVID test. You need to show that you've been to a certain place, certain countries that had outbreaks, or you interacted with somebody who had it and you have symptoms. But then the next day, Monday, March 16, I went back, and that at that point, my oxygen was low and I was really having difficulty breathing. They admitted me to the hospital. And when you get admitted with COVID symptoms, they will test you. So that's when I got the test for coronavirus, and it turned out positive.
And so do you think you were an example of community transmission then? You didn't have any? Okay.
Yes, wow. Definitely. It was classic community spread. I don't recall interacting with somebody who had it. I could have gotten it anywhere, because before the lockdown, I did all the things a busy New Yorker would do. I would go to the gym, I ride the subway, I go to the theater. I don't know where I got it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. So you were in the hospital for how many weeks?
So about 2.5 weeks overall. My first couple of days there, I was fairly stable. They gave me supplemental oxygen. But then around the fifth or so day I was in the hospital, my condition took a turn for the worse. My oxygen went down. My lungs were filling with fluid. I had acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS as they call it. And at that point, I had to be put on a ventilator. So I was intubated. They put a breathing tube into my mouth, down my throat to help me breathe. I was unconscious for all of this, thankfully. They gave me sedation and I was knocked out. And for 6 days, I was hooked up to this ventilator that was doing my breathing for me because I couldn't breathe on my own. Luckily, I was able to come off the ventilator. Not everybody does. And then I spent about another 6 to 7 days in the hospital, just getting my strength back and still getting more oxygen. But they just gradually lowered the amount of oxygen until I could breathe normal room air. And then on April 1, they discharged me.
And it was no joke. No April Fool's joke.
No, exactly. As I put on Twitter. Yep.
Yes. Awesome. Awesome. Oh, that's amazing. And your husband also had COVID, but not severe symptoms, right?
Yes. I think our stories are a reminder of how this disease can affect people very differently. He had about a week of what he would describe as a bad flu, but then he recovered. For a lot of people, about 7 to 10 days into the sickness is when you kind of realize either A, I'm going to get better, or B, I'm going to get worse and maybe need hospitalization. For me, I think one thing that contributed to my bad case is I do have a history of asthma. It was very well controlled. As a child, I had childhood asthma. I outgrew it essentially. But then as an adult, I had exercise-induced asthma. I would get asthma or wheezing if I exercised too hard, but I could just take an inhaler before working out and I was fine. But I think that that condition did make me more susceptible to this bad case of COVID.
So I think when people have a brush with death, I think similar to what you certainly experienced, they often say they learned something. So what have you learned from your experience with COVID?
Well, I guess a couple of things. I mean, first, I think I've learned what a dangerous disease this can be. I'm 44. I'm in relatively good health, overweight, don't have other than this asthma, which was well controlled. I didn't really have any other underlying conditions, no diabetes, no hypertension. But I got a very severe case of it. So I think that's one thing that I do try to impart, that this isn't just a disease for the elderly or the disease for the super sick. You can be in relatively good health and still wind up in the hospital with it. And a second thing I learned, which is perhaps a bit cliched, but I really just have a greater appreciation for life. I mean, I think you just take so many things for granted. And then when you're at the, you're fighting for your life, you just realize how important and amazing it is. And then I guess the third and final thing is I just have a greater appreciation for relationships, because I had so many friends and family and strangers who were pulling for me, praying for me, thinking of me during this whole ordeal. And so I just have a greater appreciation for that.
Yes, I know. I mean, I was following really closely on your Twitter, waiting for updates. And so, you know, we were praying for you here and just so happy to see you doing better. So you've been involved with efforts to fight COVID or to research COVID to have a better understanding of it. You've donated blood and you are following the news very closely, you know, obviously. Are you optimistic for a cure or a vaccine or something that'll get us back to whatever the new normal, you know, to use the cliche, is going to be?
So it's funny. I actually am fairly optimistic, but it may be a case of motivated reasoning where you want something, so you think it's going to happen. It's funny, like I, even though I had a very serious case of it and almost died from it, I really do want to get back to life, to normal life. I really do want us to reopen, just as long as it's safe. And so on that, of course, I defer to the judgments of the public health experts and the doctors, but I am optimistic. There are a bunch of vaccines that are now in trials, which is amazing considering how this disease is only really less than a year old, in trials in England, in China, in the US. And then in terms of treatments, there have been a couple of things that have shown some promise. Remdesivir was in a trial that showed it could decrease the duration of the illness. There's now a three drug cocktail that was also in trials that has shown some promise. Again, it's not clear that all things work for all people, and they really may just reduce the severity or length of illness, as opposed to suddenly you take this and you're better the next day. But I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic, because there is so much attention and so much in the way of resources that is being devoted to this. If you think about, for example, back in the 1980s with the HIV/AIDS crisis, where it was in many ways neglected because people thought, oh, it only affects gay people or it only affects intravenous drug users. This is something that affects a lot of people. It's dominating the headlines around the world, and a lot of money and a lot of effort are going into fighting it.
Well, certainly when you have countries where the prime minister and the heir, you know, get COVID, there's certainly attention put to it. So now you're working from home and you have your husband and a 2-year-old. How is it? How's it going? You have any funny war stories with a little toddler running around?
Yeah, like, you know, it is, I was, the other day, I was trying to listen remotely to Supreme Court oral arguments, and I kind of missed some questions from Justice Alito because my son basically plopped himself down on the couch next to me and insisted that we were driving somewhere. He likes to pretend to drive, and he treats the couch like the front seat of a car. So occasionally you have interruptions like that, which a lot of working parents are dealing with. But I have to say, we are actually more fortunate than most. We usually live in Manhattan, but since this all happened, and since I came home from the hospital, we came out to New Jersey, which is where my parents live and where my parents-in-law live. They live out of the New Jersey suburbs, and we kind of bounce back and forth between my parents' house and my husband's parents' house. And the great thing about that is, well, it's great on many levels to be with family during a time like this, but the grandparents can look after our son during the day when we're trying to work. So we take frequent breaks to play with him or take a walk or do this or that. But when I have something like this, like a Zoom or an interview or a call, I can close the door and I know that someone is watching him. So we are actually super, super lucky considering the struggles that a lot of families are trying to go through in terms of trying to, you know, watch their kids and get their jobs done. Some of them have to homeschool their kids or cooperate with remote learning. Whereas for us, we don't have to, he's not in school yet. He's not yet three, supposed to be going in the fall. We'll see if that happens. But we haven't had to deal with that either.
Because David's voice was still recovering after 8 days on a ventilator, Tessa's conversation with him took place over two different days. On the second day, the conversation shifted to David's thoughts about how the pandemic would affect the practice of law, and particularly big law, over the long term.
So I guess I have maybe three predictions for how life in big law, the world of large law firms, might be different post-pandemic. And actually, I think a lot of these things are good. The first, I think, is law firms are going to be much more open to remote working, telecommuting, people working from home. Law firms are kind of stodgy and conservative, and sometimes they can be a little bit FaceTime focused. But now they've seen that you can do so much from home. And in many cases, lawyers I talk to say they're more productive at home, provided that, for example, they don't have interruptions like kids, which I know you and I can relate to. But, you know, if they can be focused and productive, law firms will be increasingly indifferent to location. I think a second thing we'll see is an acceleration of this trend already of lawyers embracing technology. Again, the stereotype is lawyers are tech Luddites, and many of us went to law school because we're not good at science and math. But we've been forced to embrace all these new technologies like Zoom, which was new to me, or Skype, which wasn't new to me but was new to many other lawyers, or Join Me, or Google Hangouts, or what have you. And so I think a lot of older lawyers were sort of forced into that. I interviewed David Boyce for a story for Above the Law, and he mentioned, yeah, like now he's, you know, going to court hearings by Zoom, and he's FaceTiming with his grandkids, and these were things he didn't know how to do before, but now he's doing them, and he thinks it's great. And then I think the third and final thing is, as happens in downturns, there's more pricing pressure on law firms, and I think law firms are going to have to deliver more value for their clients, because when there's less work to go around, firms have to compete more, and they really have to bring their A game. And I think that's a good thing too, if law firms don't get sort of complacent, but instead feel they need to deliver real value to their clients.
I was talking to Sean Murata a couple weeks ago about, you know, for this podcast, and he mentioned that law firms might be looking at downsizing even office location as more attorneys work from home. Do you think that's a real possibility?
Oh, absolutely. That was already a trend in law firms. I kind of am a little bit obsessed with law firm office buildouts. I used to cover them at Above the Law. We still do, actually. And there was already a trend in terms of in the direction of taking less space. Some firms, for example, like Cooley, have moved to more open plan, where lawyers have sort of private cubes. So they're not totally open. They have little overhangs and they're soundproofed. But they take up less space than a traditional office. So law firms were already reducing square foot per lawyer, which is a big, big cost of theirs. They're competing in some cases with virtual firms, which don't have that cost. And this is just going to allow them to do that more. If law firms work on shifts post-pandemic, where they say, okay, some of you come in Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and some of you come in Tuesday, Thursday, They'll need less office space. It'll be more like a tech company model of, what do they call it, docking or hoteling or whatever they call it, where maybe you have a desk and there's a plug-in for your laptop, but that'll be your desk today and somebody else's desk tomorrow.
So maybe more money on cleaning and disinfecting, less money on lots of offices.
Exactly.
All right. We are seeing furloughs and layoffs, which of course is reminiscent of the downturn in 2009 that I know law schools are just recovering from, and I'm not as familiar with law firms. Do you see another extended downturn, or do you think once COVID is under control, if it ever is, we'll be more back to normal?
So it's funny, maybe I'll get the prediction wrong again. Earlier this year, I predicted this was going to be a small blip for law firms, and I think I was wrong about that. And now I'm going to predict that, no, I think there will be an extended period of disruption, because even after it's safe to go back to work, according to public health experts, there's going to be a lag time, I think, before companies are comfortable doing big deals. There could be a lag time in terms of moving forward with litigation. It'll depend a lot on when courts will open up. And so I think that it's going to, look, nobody can predict the future. Who knows? Maybe we'll be lucky and a vaccine will come out tomorrow. But I think that law firms should be prepared for an extended, tough time.
Tessa then turned the conversation to the courts, asking David whether he thought the current practice of Zoom and telephonic oral arguments would continue, and if so, for how long?
I think yes, as long as we have the public health considerations that we have right now. But I think that eventually things will return to in-court argument. And a lot of advocates and a lot of judges I've talked to do appreciate the experience of going into an actual physical courtroom and seeing the judges and seeing opposing counsel. And a lot of times little subtleties can be lost. I think Zoom is actually quite impressive, but occasionally there'll be a lag. Occasionally there will be some distortion. And I think in real life, it's just much better to be able to react in real time to the questioners and the witnesses and your opposing counsel. So I think we will eventually return to real life arguments.
Do you think attorneys who may have to travel, for example, from DC to San Francisco will have the option of telephonic arguments or Zoom arguments?
Yes, I do think that we will have a return to in-person arguments, but in cases where it may not seem worth the cost or the hassle, judges are now increasingly comfortable with video or oral argument telephonically, and I think they will avail themselves more of that. I was going back and forth with two friends of mine who are now judges, and that's what they were saying, that I think, yes, they want to return to the courtroom, but because they've discovered that this technology is there and it's actually quite user-friendly, in situations where, say, a client that doesn't have that deep pockets doesn't want to front the travel costs to, you know, fly across the country to California or something for, say, a Ninth Circuit argument, now that can be done by video or by phone. And some of the judges like it. There was one Ninth Circuit argument where a judge was joking that underneath his robes he was wearing shorts. So they're kind of discovering what the rest of us have already discovered, which is there are nice things about working from home.
I think I might be able to guess who that judge was.
Yeah, I have a good idea.
Speaking of judges, what are the judges, you know, obviously you don't have to call anyone out, but what are the judges saying to you about embracing technology? I've worked with a few and, you know, even judges who are not super familiar with technology have been really good sports about learning it. So what's your experience been?
So I've actually been really impressed. Most of the judges I know have embraced it. It's funny, when I clerked, I remember that my judge, Judge O'Scanlan in the Ninth Circuit, he used to dictate emails, and then his secretary would type them up and send them to us. And now he will just type things himself on his phone. So I think, and that, you know, that took place years ago, but I think it's just an indicator that judges are like the rest of us. They're just like us. If they find a technology that makes it easier for them to do their work, they will embrace it.
So what about the Supreme Court? I've been seeing a lot of news articles about Justice Thomas. This has sort of been his moment to shine with this new format of argument. There's been some mishaps that I've read about too. And I know you mentioned last time that you've been listening to some of the Supreme Court arguments. So what are your thoughts on the change to the Supreme Court? Will we ever see the court do Zoom? You know, who would have the best green screen background if they did? What are your thoughts on that?
I think my guess for best green screen background would probably be Justice Sotomayor. You know, she's a very adventurous person. Her memoir is a lot of fun. She, you know, likes to try new experiences. She likes good food and dancing. I could see her having something fun. But I don't know that we're going to see Zoom just yet. It was already a huge, huge step for them to live stream arguments, to have them in real time as opposed to post them at the end of the week. But what I'm hoping the court has seen from this is it's not the end of the world. Historically, the court has been resistant to these types of moves. And now they've seen that it's totally fine. And they're not being turned into, well, maybe sometimes they are, but they're not being turned into memes on Twitter or something in some way that's terrible. And people can comment in real time on what they're saying. But in some ways that was already the case because you had reporters for places like SCOTUS blog that were reporting on things pretty contemporaneously. So I think the court one sees that it's not the end of the world if they live stream and they make themselves more available to the public. And two, I think that I like this new system of the Chief Justice calling on each justice in order of seniority. So everybody gets some bite at the apple as opposed to just the justices who are most aggressive in squeezing themselves in, which is why, as you mentioned, Justice Thomas, who historically hasn't loved participating in that free-for-all, has actually asked a lot of questions. A proposal I just floated on my Twitter feed today was, when we go back to normal, what if we had a situation where there's one initial round of questioning that is moderated by the chief, where each justice gets one round of questions, and then after that, you can have a free-for-all.
So do you predict in-person in fall for SCOTUS?
Oh gosh, that's hard to say. I hope so. I'm always trying to be optimistic. So I don't know, maybe it's a 50-50 shot at this point. I really hope so though. You know, even though I had a terrible experience with this disease and I believe it has to be taken really seriously, I do miss normal life. And I'd love to return to it as soon as the experts say it's safe to do so.
It will be interesting to see which of David's predictions come to pass. And we're so grateful that he's still in this world to share them with us. Since his release from the hospital, David Latt has been outspoken about the gravity of grappling with the virus that causes COVID-19. Intermingled with tweets conveying his appreciation for the playful pop culture references in Justice Kagan's opinions, insightful analysis of SCOTUS decisions, and informed speculations about judicial appointments and retirements, you'll find sharp critiques of state decisions to hold in-person bar exams in July 2020, observations about the impact of unequal access to healthcare, and sobering first-person accounts of the lingering effects experienced by those who have, quote, survived infection with the virus. If you're not already following David Latt on Twitter, you should be. You can find him at David Latt. David published his first novel, Supreme Ambitions, about a Yale law grad with ambitions to clerk for the Supreme Court, back in 2014. You can get it in hard copy wherever books are sold. It's a perfect mid-pandemic summer read for the law nerds among us. I just added it to my e-reader myself. You can watch a video version of this episode at the Appellate Advocacy blog, which Professor Dysart edits, at lawprofessors.typepad.com/appellate_advocacy. The video was posted on Monday, June 8th, 2020. Please look for future episodes of Practice in Place on the Arizona Law website at law.arizona.edu/legal-writing. We're also now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, the Google Podcast app, Anchor, and wherever you listen to podcasts. Please share, subscribe, rate, and review to help us reach new listeners. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Practice in Place. We'll share additional content related to each new episode there. You can also follow us on Twitter at Practice Viral and on Instagram at Practice Pod. And you can follow the U Arizona Law Legal Writing Team on Twitter at UA Law LegalWriting. Practice in Place is a production of the Legal Writing Program at the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law. Special thanks to James Alvarez, our talented editor, whom we must credit for everything about this podcast that sounds polished or professional. We hope to continue providing a window into how the COVID-19 crisis has impacted our courts and the practice of law, and also sharing our insights into what the response to the crisis tells us about the past, present, and future of our courts and the legal profession. Until next time, thanks.